This free program is paid for by the listeners of Redwood Community Radio. If you're not already a member, think of joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of Redwood Community Radio. If you're not already a member, think of joining us to help keep free speech alive.
InfoFest, the Little Green Phone Book, connecting our communities. All right, that time is almost exactly 7 o'clock. Temperature outside our K-Mud studios here in downtown Redway, 58 degrees. Stay tuned now for Democracy in Action. K-Mud listeners, this is John Zaglin sitting in with Democracy Unlimited's Food and Democracy Director Megan Murphy. We're filling in for with David Cobb and for Caitlin Sabosi Belknap tonight, who are down in the Bay Area joining Rabbi Michael Lerner and the Network of Spiritual Progressives working on the campaign to legalize democracy. This is Democracy Unlimited's coalition response to the January 21st Supreme Court decision to legalize corporate electioneering across the board. Tonight, we're joined by Liar Keith, who is a small farmer and radical feminist activist. She's the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability, which has already been called the most important ecological book of this generation. Also, K-Mud listeners would be interested to know that she is currently co-writing a book with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay called Deep Green Resistance, which is about a strategy for the environmental movement. We're also joined by Erin Durden-Little, who grew up in Humboldt, but really developed her interest in agriculture and food as a Peace Corps volunteer in Bolivia. After completing her master's degree at UC Davis in the area of agriculture and community development, she returned to the North Coast to work on the field crew at Redwood Roots Farm, where she now coordinates educational activities for youth and adults. Thank you so much both for joining us here at the studio.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So just this past weekend, I was actually talking with Grady Walker, who's one of our community's most phenomenal farmers out at Greenfire Farm, and I was really surprised to hear him say that he projects our local food capacity in Humboldt County to be merely 5%. That means that we're importing approximately 95% of the produce into this county to feed ourselves. Lear, it begs the question, what is true food sustainability in agriculture?
Well, if you really want to answer that question in the most radical way, you have to go back 10,000 years to the beginnings of agriculture. Now, when I say agriculture, I am talking very specifically about annual monocrops, so grain crops like corn or wheat or soy or oats. A lot of people talk about agriculture, they're thinking vegetables, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about those annual monocrops that essentially take over continents once they get going. So we need to understand what agriculture is if we're really going to talk about sustainability, because agriculture is essentially a war against the planet. You take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and you plant it to human use. So it's essentially biotic cleansing, and I mean down to the bacteria. So what this means is that the animals that live there have nowhere else to go, and that's a nice word for extinction. And it also has let the human population grow to gigantic proportions because you're essentially funneling all of this life support directly into just growing more humans. So it's a monocrop of humans in the end. One of the other problems, of course, is that this can never be sustainable because it is destroying the topsoil. The moment that you clear that soil to plant those crops, it's drawdown. And the planet at this point is basically out of topsoil. And we owe our entire existence to 6 inches of topsoil and the fact that it rains. So this is why writers like Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, say that agriculture is the worst mistake that human beings ever made, because we are now dependent on it. And what we've become dependent on is a way of life that's destroying the planet. The planet cannot support 6 or 7 billion people. And the only reason that we are doing this is because we're drying down the soil. So I like to talk about peak soil. I mean, we've heard about peak oil. We know about fossil water, you know, other kind of fossil substances that our culture is now using to support itself. But one of those is soil, and it's invisible. This is a huge environmental catastrophe that's sort of waiting in the wings, and we're not even aware of it as a problem. By 1950, the major grain-growing regions of the world were actually out of soil, and what should have happened was a correction in the human numbers. What happened instead was the Green Revolution. What it meant was that instead of using soil, instead of drawing down the natural reserves of soil that we had been drawing down for those 10,000 years, we learned to use fossil fuel instead. So using gas and oil, they learned how to make fertilizer during World War II, and that has now been applied across the world, creating even more problems and a quadrupling of the human population. So when I talk about sustainability, I need to go all the way back to the beginning and talk about how all of those living communities have been essentially funneled into creating more human beings. The native grasslands are now 99% destroyed, and the native forests are 98% destroyed. The oceans are 90% fished out, and we can talk about rivers and wetlands and what's happened to them. This all goes back to this pattern of human settlement called civilization, and agriculture is the basis of that. If you are living in populations that are too dense to be supported by the local land base, you then have to go out and take what you need from other people. So agriculture, this pattern called civilization, is also the beginning of militarism, and it's the beginning of slavery, and it's the beginning of hierarchically structured human society. So this has basically been a disaster across the planet. And in small rural areas like Humboldt County, we actually have an opportunity to face that square on. What have human beings been doing for 10,000 years? There are still people here who remember what it means to live in a culture that actually participates in the land base instead of destroying it. There are still native people in the region. They would still like to have their culture and their land back. The salmon cultures here were very successful. They lived here for 12,000 years and didn't destroy a thing. So we need to be asking these really big questions about what agriculture has done to our planet, what it has done to us, to our health, what it has done to the habitat for the other animals we should be sharing this planet with. And we need to be talking very seriously now about, you know, if we've run out of topsoil and we're running out of fossil fuel, what does that mean for the future? If, you know, it takes 10 calories of oil now to produce 1 calorie of food, and we're looking at the downside of, you know, the peak oil curve, we should be very nervous about what is going to happen. And I think that places like Humboldt have a lot more resilience because they are rural communities. They are communities that still have some capacity to provide for their own food. If we can identify the problem correctly, there's every hope that we could actually institute local food security, local political security, local cultural security, and that we could have a way of life that was, you know, democratic across the board. But that really starts with food, and it starts with truly sustainable food and the kind of food that we could grow in Humboldt that would actually build topsoil and repair the living world rather than continuing to participate in these ways of life that destroy it.
Garrett, you seem to be a proponent for grass-fed beef and that being among the primary ways that we in Humboldt can help to regrow our grasslands and provide nutritious protein to people. Many in the environmental movement tend to think that a vegetarian diet is the most environmentally sound decision that one can make if he wants to eat more to reduce global warming. Is the vegetarian diet the best way for humanity across the board to reduce our emissions?
No, and this is a huge part of how we've been led astray. And I want to say very clearly that, you know, the values that underlie vegetarianism are values that I think we all agree with and, you know, try to live by, be justice, sustainability, you know, anything that questions human hubris or, you know, human entitlement, all of that. Those are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. So I'd say the ignorance is really, you know, the bifurcation point here, that there's a whole bunch of information that we just don't have because we live in an agricultural society. We don't know that we can question agriculture. But when you understand that agriculture is biotic cleansing and that it has essentially run through every continent except Antarctica, that we've come to the end of this way of life, that right now the only way to keep producing those foods is to use fossil fuel, you start to see that, that there's a limit to, these kinds of human technologies, and that, if they are based on drawdown and destruction, that there is no future in them. So a lot of the statistics that we're told about meat are true for fossil fuel. For factory farming, it is absolutely true that, you can pour all this grain into animals, and it's a terrible waste of calories. And when you put all their excrement into these huge manure pits, that that releases a lot of methane. So I think that we can all agree that factory farming has got to end. The solution is not to keep doing agriculture, because more of the same will not save us. The solution is actually to repair those biotic communities. And the best way to repair most of them is grassland. They should be prairies. So just to give you an example, if we took all of the trashed out agricultural land from the Dakotas east on this continent, and we put it back into grassland of some sort, the United States would immediately become a net carbon sink. And that's with everybody still driving their SUVs from here to hell. If we did that across the planet, if we repaired all the native grasslands, the entire world could then start sequestering that carbon. And in somewhere between 10 to 15 years, we could actually sequester all the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. To me, this is the most hopeful news that anyone could provide. Considering the really frightening things that are going to happen to us if we don't start sequestering that carbon. I mean, the planet could be hotter than Venus in 100 years, which means there will be no life. And grasslands are really, really good at sequestering carbon. So I think that, we need to start understanding the role of soil and the role of plants and the role of animals in creating those kind of resilient biotic communities that actually sequester carbon. The beginning of agriculture is actually the beginning of global warming. The reason is because when you introduce all that oxygen into the soil, you're causing organic matter to decay at a really quick rate, and that releases a lot of carbon. It also releases a lot of methane. In fact, there was one study recently in Science magazine that showed that every single tillage system contributed to global warming, wheat and soy being the worst. So my new slogan is wheat is murder. But, we need to be repairing. I mean, if we look at agriculture as destroy, destroy, destroy for 10,000 years, we need to reverse that process and repair, repair, repair. And, functioning grasslands with the appropriate ruminants can do that. I mean, that those 10 years is, all it would take to sequester all of that carbon that is now heating our planet up to some pretty scary levels.
Here, I have two questions for you. The first would be, do you, in terms of this expansive history of agriculture, do you distinguish getting to somewhat of a race to the bottom in terms of industrial agriculture, corporate-controlled industrial agriculture, to be specific, and small family farms? And the second question would be, given, this information that repairing our grasslands is fundamental for global warming issues and climate change and everything aside, what do you think the solutions are as far as making sure that first that Humboldt County can feed itself, that we address these issues of local food security, and that we move into being able to both grow vegetables and meat and or repair, our salmon rivers? But also, how do we make sure, so in an effort to address the local food security, how do we do that? But also, how do we make sure that we are fed in a way that's sustainable to the community?
Right. Well, to take your first question, you put the whole process on steroids and you end up with sort of the corporate model, which has certainly accelerated the entire process across the globe and made it, 20 times worse. But, I would back that up, and you can see that, starting, at the very beginning of civilization, it starts in seven different centers around the world, and the same pattern happens over and over, where you have this power center, this bloated power center at the middle, and they engage in agriculture, which lets there be a military class. the military class is also required by agriculture because you're always using up your land base. So you've got to go out into the country and take the resources that you've used up. Nobody willingly gives up their trees, their soil, their water. So you have to have this class of people called soldiers, and their job is to go out and get what the bloated power center needs. The whole thing collapses. And it used to be limited by the supply lines. Without telephones and airplanes, you could only get so far using pack animals and human feet. Therefore, the Roman Empire could only get so big. The Greeks could only get so big. The Chinese empires could only get so big. Eventually, the whole system would collapse. Between the drawdown and, you know, the lack of communication and the ability to get supplies to the soldiers, it could only get so big. The whole thing would start all over again. And this is the pattern that humans have been on for 10,000 years. You know, what they call the Great Plowing, which was, you know, the destruction of the American Midwest prairies, that happened with oxen, horses, and humans. It did not require fossil fuel. That was before the invention of the internal combustion engine. So humans alone can be quite destructive. You know, when they're using the wrong kinds of technologies, all of that gets accelerated with the beginning of corporate power, corporate personhood, and then the invention of fossil fuel. So by 1950, you know, you've got basically the end of the natural topsoil. You've got the introduction of fossil fuel fertilizer, and then you've got corporate personhood, corporate power taking over. At this point, across the globe, there are 6 corporations that control the entire world food supply. And what they do is, in the United States, they treat family farmers as if they are serfs. Because they have such a monopoly, they can drive the price of grain below the cost of production. This means if you're a farmer somewhere in Minnesota or Nebraska, no matter how hard you work, you cannot make a living. You are utterly dependent on the federal government for handouts to make up the difference, and that's because of the monopoly of the grain cartels. Because the grain is so cheap, they have then been able to go into countries around the world and destroy their local economies by selling, by doing what they call agricultural dumping. They sell products at half the price that the local farmers can produce it. And they have created urban squalor, misery, and suicide in every country that they have touched. And you can talk to any food activist from around the world, and they will tell you the number one thing they want is for us to get the hell out of their countries and take our cheap agricultural goods with us. Because it's just destroyed everything and created this huge swollen misery of cities in the third world because the farmers are driven off their land. We will never have food security in this country or anywhere else as long as corporate personhood stands. And people really need to get that as a concept that these people are not our friends and they are indeed treating everybody like they are serfs. So I would say that, you know, the corporate food corporations, these giant grain cartels, are the enemy of all of us. Including anybody who cares about food security, and certainly the small farmers here and everywhere around the globe. You know, and another example of this, I spent many years living in New England. I'm a new transplant to Humboldt County. And, you know, watching what the dairy farmers there went through, and it was the exact same process where, you know, because they could not sell their products directly to the public, they were stuck having to sell them to these, you know, giant conglomerates. So they got maybe 10, 15 cents a gallon for milk. And where some of us were able to make from the farm sales legal for raw milk, and they were able to get $4, $5, $6 a gallon. I mean, I watched these farms spring to life all around me because farmers could finally make a living. And what it meant was getting corporate America the hell out of the food supply and letting people have a direct relationship to those farms, to the animals, to the soil, to the people. It meant that the whole process was done well, and it was done humanely. It was done to human scale, and the farmers could immediately make a living. And the same is true for grass-fed beef. You don't need a tractor. You don't need $100,000 loan. You know, you don't need any of this kind of supplies, and these farmers can immediately make money if they can sell directly to the consumer. What's standing in the way, of course, is corporate power and the way that they've been able to change the laws federally, regionally, locally, so that they can't sell directly to the consumers. But we've got to remove those laws. So at whatever level you want to get involved with, there's plenty of room. In the background, we all always have to keep in mind that it's corporate personhood that has created, you know, vast amounts of these problems because they want us to be dependent and they want farmers to be serfs. And all of us are now dependent for, you know, our basic sustenance on people who are in this to make a living. They're, you know, to make a great deal of profit. They're not in this to feed us. These aren't our local community people who care about us and who have personal relationships to us and want us all to be fed, you know, in a way that creates social capital, not just, you know, money capital, but actually creates community and creates the bonds that should be there between people, animals, soil, you know, rain, rivers, sun, the way that we all, you know, used to live and can live again, especially in rural areas like Humboldt. I'm sorry, did I answer your question or was there more?
Yeah, no, you did. That was definitely the first part of the question. And you actually gave us a great opportunity to talk about, I'm sure most of you out there are aware of the most recent Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, where, as John mentioned early in the show, essentially corporate power extends well into our elections already. But as a result of this decision, essentially corporations can explicitly and openly decide who gets to take office.
This means Monsanto may decide right. that certain legislation will do favorably by them, and that they can essentially bribe legislators to support their policies by, you know, suggesting that $25 million may just go to an advertising blitz in the next election should that elected official not find their policies favorable. That offers a level of pressure that we certainly don't need. It takes us further towards the embrace of the legal doctrine of corporate personhood, which basically gives human rights to corporations so that our rights, our Bill of Rights protections, become meaningless.
It also makes it incredibly difficult for us to exercise local democracy. So corporations having this type of power, this type of legal personhood, which is a fictional doctrine, being that they are a created entity, means that elections or people who run for our office who, for instance, may have the interests of the family farmer or of the community as a whole in terms of how we're going to meet our food security needs and also how we're going to protect our land base are competing against people, as John just said, who are sponsored by, directly endorsed by Monsanto and the like.
I know a lot of the KMUD listeners have already visited our site, movetoamend.org. We've seen the SOHUM locales pop up, and signing on to that resolution to move towards the abolishment of corporate personhood through the 28th Amendment is a great way to get involved with this effort. Towards that end, this Saturday, February 20th, from 3 to 6 p.m., we'll be hosting an interactive community forum to determine how our county is going to respond to the Citizens United decision. And that's going to be at the Greenway Partners, 1385 8th Street in Arcata, this Saturday, 3 to 6, two of the most revolutionary acts that we can take to take back community control over corporations is to abolish the doctrine of corporate personhood through a truly grassroots people's movement, and two, to take control over our food systems. If we're not independent and in control over our own bodies and our local food and monetary systems, there's no way that we can ever revolt against the other controls that corporations have over our lives. And towards that end, I'd like to turn the conversation over to Aaron Durden-Little and see what the local scene is looking like. Our community farmers are working extremely hard, and I know they require tremendous support, the backing of a political movement in our county, and also just some live power, some sweat out on the farms. Where do things stand at the moment, Aaron, and how can our community really support our farmers?
Thank you. First, I just want to say that I agree with Lierre on a lot of counts about industrial agriculture and corporate control thereof, but I also prefer to make a distinction, just like when she makes a distinction between factory farming and pasture-based animal agriculture. The difference between corporate monocultures in destroyed prairie land versus an agriculture like you would see here in Humboldt County. Here in Humboldt, we do not actually have a presence of corporate agriculture in the direct sense. 100% of our agriculture here is family-based or sole proprietorships, people who are living here who aren't controlling things from a distance. And I think that in itself, just like she said, we have a huge opportunity here to be self-sufficient in Humboldt County because of that fact. We have people intensely caring for the land and the food that they're producing from it and giving back to that land as much as they can. That said, we have a great culture of small-scale farms that run the gamut of retail and wholesale production to CSAs. We have some innovative projects in the work. There are lots of farmers trying to start things like poultry cooperatives, starting to do pasture-based animals for meat and milk CSAs. We have a small-scale grain operation in Humboldt County. We can get beans, we can get potatoes, we can get animal protein, we can get vegetables. It's the diversity here is amazing. That's made possible by the diversity of climates, both here on the coast and inland. CAF has been working for the last 7 years or so to build support for that farming community that we have here. I want to say that CAF, the growers' associations, and all the local ag groups think that the first step to food security in this county is to make sure that everyone's encouraged to raise at least some of their own food, no matter how small that is. After that, though, we need to make sure that we have a stable local agricultural base and that people know what's going on, that there's some food system education. And CAF does a couple things to address those points here in the county. We have a market development and an institutional sales program that has been trying to make sure that farmers have access to markets that make economic sense for them. That's bottom line. Currently, we have a net import of agricultural products into the county, like you said. We have a lot of land here. We have farmers willing to grow food, but if it doesn't make sense for them economically, there's not much that they can do about it. So Melanie Patrick, who's been working on that program, connects local farmers to institutional buyers, the food service programs at things like Humboldt State University or our local elementary school districts. She's also been working on a Buy Fresh, Buy Local branding campaign to increase the visibility of farmers in the community. And finally has been researching the state of distribution in our county. If the food can't get to where it needs to go, that's a challenge in any sort of question of food security. You can have all the available food you want, but if there's not access to it, then you're going to have that infrastructure question hang over your head. So that's been a huge challenge that she continues to work on with other organizations in the county. Another thing that our membership-based chapter's been pushing for in the last year during the general plan update process is to make sure that we have the farmland that we need to produce the food that we need, to prevent the conversion of agricultural soils and to maintain the maximum amount of agricultural land and parcels and sizes of parcels that will sustain all sorts of agricultural production with all the range that happens here in Humboldt.
I think there's a fair parallel to the situation the Easter Islanders faced. They, of course, cut down all of the trees on Easter Island because their main source of food was the rich deep-sea fish, and they created long canoes, went out, and there came a point where they were bringing so many fish that it allowed their population to boom. At some point, you have to imagine that they were looking at those last few trees and had to decide, shall we cut down these last few trees and fish a few more days and go hungry tomorrow, or shall we let these trees stand and start dealing with less today? And of course, they made the prior decision, the wrong decision, and their civilization ended in bloodshed and cannibalism. Today in Humboldt, you know, our land represents, you know, what the trees did, or maybe even petroleum in the larger society. We can choose to cut back on the use of petroleum to ship in food, and we can start making sharper decisions about land use policy in this county and doing with a little bit less and making sure that in the long term we're one of those communities that is resilient, because as the last barrels of petroleum are burned and communities around the country find that they're living on top of asphalt, it's going to be a far more difficult process to tone things back than it would be for those of us who start with a smart platform today. And with that said, I really think that our community farmers are dealing with far too many pressures. I was talking to Jacques Newcomb in the last family of the farmers market season, and he was talking about having very good relationships with the people from whom he rents his land. But in truth, he rents from about 5 different people. And sometimes he's forced to make bad farming decisions because he's uncertain whether he's going to have access to one of those parcels in the following year. This past season, his apple crop was damaged, he had been told that he wouldn't have access to that land the following year, so he let those damaged apples remain on the tree. A few weeks later, he was informed he would have access and immediately had to get labor out there to pull those apples off the tree before they sucked up more nutrients from the land, get irrigation out there, and with all of the challenges and pressures on community farmers, it seems totally unfair for land use policy to be forcing them to rent land from, you know, five different people and have those extra challenges. It seems to me that if we are to achieve local food security, it's not really brain surgery. We need to have a political, sound political decisions, ensuring that we don't lose one more acre that's capable of providing for life, that we resuscitate the rivers so we're not forced to buy dyed aquaculture salmon, but we can bring back the coho. And to do that, we need to make sure that people are informed. So I like that CAF's platform begins with education and people empowering themselves by growing whatever portion of food they can. And I really want to applaud the Soham homesteading movement, which has embraced that. And I think that over the years, there could be a strong collaboration between the urban homesteading that I see cropping up among my friends in Eureka and Arcata in the Bay Area, and those people who have started the long project of relearning how to live on the land of Humboldt County. I'd like to open up the lines to listeners who'd like to join this conversation. I'd be especially interested to those people who are living as self-sufficiently as possible right now, and to see if there are any lessons that can be shared to start offering that cross-pollination. The number is 923-3911, or call us on our dime at 1-800-568-3723. Now, to continue this idea of a community dialogue, Aaron, I know that CAF is helping to promote a food security forum on Saturday, February 27th. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a culmination of a couple projects, one being the research that Melanie Patrick has done on the distribution system, what exists and what gaps there are in Humboldt County. But it's co-coordinated with the North Coast Co-op as well. And there's going to be a panel of speakers that talk about information that they have, that they've either gleaned, researched, or just from experience know about the food system in Humboldt County right now. And it's going to give participants the opportunity to create a vision of where we want to go with that and how to get there. That's going to be on February 27th, Saturday, like you said, from 1:30 to 5:30 at the D Street Community Center in Arcata. You can find out a lot more about that forum on the North Coast Co-op website, and they do ask that you register in advance as well.
We'd like to open up the lines. I know they're filling up fast.
Hello?
Hi, you're on Democracy in Action. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I want to ask a question. Maybe it's kind of a philosophical question as well as a practical one. First, I want to say I'm not a vegetarian myself, but a lot of people are vegetarians because they think that vegetarianism is going to save the planet. There's a popular book going around called The World Peace Diet. Even though you say that agriculture is the cause of a lot of war because people have to go out and conquer other lands to grow all the food they want to grow. You know, for so long, mankind would not have lived without eating animals. I mean, for thousands and thousands of years, agriculture, what do you say, is only 10,000 years old?
Yeah, that's correct.
So, but so many vegetarians say that they think that eating meat is bad because it makes animals suffer. You know, to kill the animal suffers, and that it's wrong to make animals suffer to feed ourselves. What do you think about that?
I would say that no matter what you eat, something is dying, and you need to ask a way bigger question than what's dead on my plate. The question you have to ask is, what died to get that food onto my plate? And in the case of agricultural foods, the answer is everything. This is a process that has run through every continent except Antarctica. But that's okay, because we can get that one with global warming. If we were to go back to a grass-based, pasture-raised kind of system in this country, it would be way healthier for humans, but it would also mean the end of feedlots and factory farming, and that's really where the misery comes in. I mean, it's just absolute torture for animals.
Well, I know, to live that way, and it seems to me if an animal is killed quickly and in the proper way, it doesn't, you know, have to suffer for very long. You know, Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, some people think that plants, you know, we don't know that much about plants. Maybe when you cut a plant down, it suffers in a way, too. We don't really know that.
We actually do know. Plants are immensely sentient. They don't move the way that we do, but they send out chemical messages to each other. And, you know, if you put two siblings next to each other, in fact, they won't compete against each other. They can recognize each other. When some plants are damaged in a community, other plants will send them help. They'll send them natural pesticides to drive off plants that are attacking insects that are attacking them. They'll send them nutrients. They will send them antibiotics. Plants actually work as a really complex community together to create more life. And they are absolutely communicating with each other.
So everything has to kill to eat. That's just a fact of life.
It is, and it's a hard fact. It's a really hard fact for a lot of people to have to negotiate, and I think that really should be the basis of our spiritual practice, is doing that well and doing it right and doing it humbly as humans, because our pride can really get in the way. And the moment that we elevate ourselves above life in a hierarchy, that's when we get into problems.
So you're saying if we don't have the big business agriculture, the big business factory farming, if we go back to what, a simpler way of life, or more community organized, more community gardens, or, you know, I don't know how you're going to, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we can't completely, you know, tell people that they can't grow acres of wheat if they want to. I mean, how do you see us changing the world to a situation where both eating meat and, vegetables is good?
Well, the nice thing about pasture-based feeding is that farmers can immediately make a profit. And so this is something that is scaling up around the country in a really quick way. So, you know,
are you talking about animals feeding on the grass?
Yeah, because people can't eat it. So it takes ruminants to eat it. But, you know, there's an association called the American Grass-Fed Association. They've got nearly 400 graziers now in this association. They can't produce meat fast enough. There are so many people now who want it. And this is all just consumer-based demand from education about how important this is.
So you don't think that a vegetarian diet is healthier than a diet that includes meat?
Not in the slightest.
Not in the slightest.
No.
I find that so refreshing to hear that, because I have been absolutely persecuted at times by vegetarians because I'm willing to kill animals or eat a dead animal.
Well, they're killing animals too. They just don't see it, and that's the problem. I was a vegan for 20 years, so I know that world inside and out.
And what made you decide to go back to meat and dairy?
My health collapsed in really profound ways.
Well, I actually heard somewhere that there's no there are cultures that are more vegetarian, like in hot tropical countries where there's lots of vegetation and it's hard to preserve meat, but that there's no natural culture that is completely vegan and doesn't eat dairy, you know, milk and eggs and stuff.
Well, you would die. There are nutrients that you can only get from animal products. And in some places, even if they try, what they're actually eating is insects that are inside their food that they don't even see. And that actually can provide just enough B12 that you survive. And when people from those cultures move to Western cultures, they do get really sick because the food here is so much cleaner that they're not actually eating the insects.
In you mentioned Antarctica. I know in the really cold places there is no vegetation.
No, I mean the Inuit, people like that, survive entirely on sea mammals and seafood. But you also have cultures that survived entirely on land mammals. So you have, the people in the, like in Canada and northern climates there, the Maasai in Africa and other cattle herders.
Well, I would imagine even in a place like, you know, Montana, where it's freezing cold in the wintertime, you know, in the winter you have to eat animal food because nothing grows. I mean, I'm talking about older times, you know, when there was no vegetation in the freezing winter.
Right, and those, when the Europeans came into contact with those cultures, there was this huge spread of books that came out throughout the 19th and early 20th century about the profound perfection of health that they found amongst those people. The diseases of civilization are caused by agricultural foods. I mean, you've got diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and all the autoimmune diseases. Hunter-gatherers are free of those diseases. There is no such thing as the diseases of hunter-gatherers. They're the diseases of civilization.
Why do they say that eating meat is bad for you? I mean, too much, I'm sure. But, like, you know, if you have heart disease, they say not to eat too much beef because the fat in the beef will give you cholesterol, or pork or whatever, that you should only eat chicken and fish. Or, I mean, what about that?
This is a really long discussion. And the best book on the subject is called Good Calories, Bad Calories, and it's by Gary Taubes, who's a science writer. And he looked into the entire history of how that myth got established across the kind of health establishment in the United States. And a lot of it is simply follow the money, that the way for corporations to make the most money was to get these cheap grain commodities and turn them into junk food. And if they could convince all of America that a high-carb, low-fat diet was the way to go, they make the most money that way. Corn is really cheap. Wheat is really cheap. And by getting us to base our diet on, you know, the current USDA food pyramid, which is, I think, at, you know, 12 servings of grain a day or something ridiculous, then they make the most money. And so it meant that, you know, the local producers who make things like, you know, dairy and eggs and meat are completely disempowered, and these giant grain cartels can make more money.
So you think that eating more protein and fat and less carbohydrates is more healthy in general?
I do, absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you. I don't want to take up all your time, but this is very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Answering those questions was Lear Keith, who has been a small farmer and is the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. We're also joined tonight by Erin Durden-Little, who's with the California Alliance with Family Farmers and Redwood Roots Farms. The calls are still coming in, so Garth, do you want to send us the next?
Hello.
Hi, you're on Democracy in Action.
Is that me?
That is you.
Okay. This has been great. I'm sitting here on a turn-of-the-century homestead. I've been here 40 years. Previous to that, from the time I was a little boy, I lived in cities and in suburbs and stuff. But as a little boy, in the Great Depression, 1933, right up until World War II, I lived on a homestead. Because that was another time when it was an economic problem. And that homestead was in Vermont, and the guy who did the homesteading in the 30s was Robert Rodale's first published book, Sam Ogden, This Country Life. And I remember that, and I guess I probably 40 years ago, or maybe 41 years ago, I decided to return to what I'd remember to that, because out there was, well, going the wrong way. It costs a lot to raise corn. If you think of it in more than money, it costs the environment and our health. And when they turn it into high fructose corn syrup, it turns into pre-diabetic. But going back to homesteading, I searched for 30 places all during the spring and summer of 1970. And when I found this place, which had been homesteaded out on in the coastal mountains in 1906, and looked it all over, its soil, its water, how it was. The guy got it for a $5 filing fee, 160 acres under the whole old Homestead Act. If we had more of those, and we had more idealistic people who not only have animals from chickens to goats, whatever, use the fertilizer and urea and so on and the spoiled alfalfa from that, and recycle it through the whole gardens and even grow a few grains and learn how, we've got a lot of people like that in Southern Humboldt.
Indeed, and thank you so much for all of your...
So we're already there, and I'm glad you guys are talking about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing the personal perspective. All right, you're on with Democracy in Action.
Good evening, Caitlin. Caitlin?
Oh, Caitlin. I recognize that voice. Caitlin is down in the Bay Area with a network
That's
of spiritual progressives. Anthony, do you have a question for our guest tonight?
Yeah. Astute DUHC scientist and barrister and friend. I am continually confounded by the following three facts and ask you to dispel or explicate our confusion. It is widely known, widely accepted, one, that the CEO health insurance executives kill 47,000 customers a year through rescission. Two, that the corporate rats, being toxic and sociopathic, kill citizens via the negligent, contaminating toxicity of food that you've been discussing. And three, that the bankster Goldman, that the gangster bankster Goldman Sachs are indeed gangsters, stealing $100 million a day, 24/7, 365 by insider trading. These facts are not only known now, they're not only accepted as being true now, but they're not acted upon now. They're not prosecuted, they're not obviated, they're not neutralized. They are exposed, but they are not prosecuted. Could you explain that?
I don't know if this crew's the best to tackle that question, but Anthony, I think you raise another good point. The effect that Lehman Brothers and all of the investment banks had on the housing situation across the country, and that we felt even here in Humboldt, where over in the housing cycle from 2001 to 2006, developers overproduced above moderate income housing by 200%, while low income housing, which typically takes up a smaller amount of land and is closer to communities and existing services, were underproduced by, I think we only achieved 43% of the state mandated projections. And at this point, we really have to look towards the general plan update. And I think Aaron knows that the Ag Resources session is going to be coming up. Is there anything that folks should know about that?
Yeah, things are coming to a head again with the general plan update, and the Planning Commission is going to continue their deliberations on the Ag Resources section of the general plan this Thursday at the Board of Supervisors Chambers in Eureka at 6 p.m. And so I do believe they're going to be taking more public comments at that time if anyone wants to go down and say that they want to support conservation of agricultural land and soils around here.
All right, we're going to take another call. You're on Democracy in Action.
Hi, my name is Helen.
Hey. Hi, Helen.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Good to hear your voice.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I thought I'd call in to see if you guys, I hadn't had a chance to listen to the entire show, and so I don't know if community gardens were touched upon as a neighborhood-level approach to food security, and I shamelessly wanted to plug this new group that's out there called the North Coast Community Gardens Collaborative.
Ellen. They haven't been touched upon yet, and I'm so glad you called, because it would be great to move this discussion into things that we can do in Humboldt County to support farmers and to support our local food security. So tell us about this Community Garden Collaborative, Helen.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, we're a network of passionate food justice people, and we all came together with some initial funding from the Humboldt Community for Activity and Nutrition, who enabled the Garden Collaborative to launch into existence as a grassroots, on-the-ground type of effort towards increasing access to food through community-based garden efforts. So community garden efforts can be, food pantry gardens, community gardens, gardens for houseless or runaway youth, school gardens, that kind of a thing. The basic premise is that they're not for profit. They're for growing food for the people who are involved. And while I think that, we don't pretend that community gardens are some sort of fix-all solution to the growing food problems, they are an essential and forgotten component of the puzzle. And people don't realize the amount of produce that comes out of some of these gardens. One particular pantry garden in McKillingville boasts 6,000 pounds of produce a year. That's a lot of food. So, I'd like to think that this level, this approach to food security is kind of like people-powered produce. Through community gardens, people are empowered to make choices around their food. And sometimes money is a prohibitive thing, in terms of making choices with your dollars in the supermarket. And, community gardens really enable people to grow the kind of foods that they want. And sometimes that means also growing culturally appropriate foods. And I think that's one of the things that makes these gardens so important.
Yeah, that sounds great, Helen. Are there ways for folks who are interested to plug in, or ways in which they can get connected with the existing community garden network?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now what we're doing is we're sort of mapping all of the existing community gardens so that we can connect people to them. And, we're trying to be a resource for a range of topics, including helping with the logistics of running a community garden, finding available land, accessing funding, how to organize volunteer days, you know, the list goes on and on. But if folks want to get in touch with us, we will be at the Planet Green Festival on April 3rd. So come on by and check us out there. We'll have a booth. We're also trying to plan a demonstration garden for the festival, but we can't promise that yet. But if you'd like to talk to us in advance, you can also call myself. My name, again, is Helen, and my number is 499-4659. Or you can call Chris at 269-2064. You can also, if I can plug away a little bit more, you can also look at our work at the Reach Out Humboldt website, which is reachouthumboldt.org.
Great. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Erin,
bye-bye.
Bye, Helen. Thanks for calling in. Erin, on another level of support that we can offer farmers is the community-supported agriculture concept. And underlying it is the idea that there is inherent risk to being an organic farmer and that our farmers should not shoulder that risk all themselves. So at the beginning of the growing season, through a CSA, members contribute money and pay the farmer up front and then receive a share throughout the growing season. And if drought or any sort of hardship were to befall the crop, the farmer will still be around the following year to propagate the important knowledge and practices of intensive organic agriculture. I'm wondering if you can give a shout out to those farms you know who are going to be engaging in CSAs this year, and if you think that that is a way that people should plug in. And also, are there any farms in southern Humboldt, and is that a growing movement down here as well?
Sure. The list of CSAs in Humboldt County continues to grow. It's been an exciting couple years, especially. Seems to be one or two added every year. Right now, we have a few clustered in the Arcata area and also inland in the Willow Creek area, and then a couple more a little bit southern. The ones I know of right now, Deep-Seated Community Farm in the Arcata Bottoms, that's Eddie Tanner. Shake Fork Community Farm, Kevin Cunningham and Melanie Olstad doing grains. Newcomb Family Farm out in Willow Creek, mostly fruit CSA. Luna Farm doing a diverse CSA, also inland in the Willow Creek area. I'm not sure if Greenfire will be offering their CSA again this year. Redwood Roots Farm is actually taking a break from the CSA, but it's going to be running, I think, one of the only farm stands in the Bayside Humboldt or Arcata area. And then Arcata Educational Farm and the College of the Redwoods Student Farm annually offer CSA shares on a historical level. And I'm not actually that familiar with the Southern Humboldt scene. I do know that they have a community farm that I believe offers CSA shares, but I can't verify that for sure.
We're your Bay Area visitor, so if anyone is out there knows of a growing CSA movement down here, please call in and let us know. And I'll just say that as we enter into the twilight of the industrial age and internet access and the ways that information is propagated in our society begin to dry up, the word of mouth and knowledge about how to provide food in living communities and on a local level is going to be among the knowledge that is most important. And right now is the time to get connected and to get our community dialed in, because peak oil has hit and the time is here. We have a few more minutes till the end of the hour, so why don't we take another call? All right, you're on Democracy in Action.
Is that me?
Yes.
Hi. I just wanted to say I appreciate the guest speaking about the big picture perspective about commercial agriculture and factory farming and stuff. But, you know, I'm really disturbed by what I'm understanding her to equate agriculture and eating food produced on the land. I'm disturbed by that being equated with, like, all the history of health and environmental problems. And I think it's really important to distinguish between, you know, agriculture and eating food simply on the land, which is what a lot of people do, especially who are conscious about being a vegetarian, you know, eating a basically vegetarian diet. You know, that's really different than, you know, large-scale agriculture, monoculture, and also processed food. Like, that's a really important difference to say. You know, you can't just say agriculture products create all these diseases. It's important to remember that simple foods is different than processed foods. And, yeah, I'll take a comment off the line. Thanks.
Thanks for calling in.
The agricultural food does, in fact, create disease. You can go back into the archaeological record. You look at the bones of the hunter-gatherers, and they are long and strong and disease-free. And then you start agriculture. And what you find then is bones that are small and brittle and riddled with evidence of diseases. We call these diseases the diseases of civilization. We do not have a concept, the diseases of hunter-gatherers, because they don't have those diseases. And it's cancer, diabetes, all the autoimmune diseases, and heart disease. And those are the diseases that are caused by eating a nutrient-poor diet of mostly sugar, which is what agricultural foods are. The human template requires the nutrient-dense foods of animal-source foods, and that is not what we've been told for the last 30 years by our public health institutions, but it is a fact. And if you talk to anybody who is a medical anthropologist, you know, they can look at a bone and tell you within 3 seconds whether it was a hunter-gatherer or an agriculturalist, because people shrink, they lose their teeth, and, yeah, all these terrible disease processes start. This is something that has been observed for over 200 years as European doctors floated around the globe, usually in, you know, support of various evil imperialist projects. But there they were on boats and came to new places that Europeans had never been before and found people who were tall and strong and had no diabetes and had no heart disease and had no autoimmune diseases, kept their teeth until they were 90, had perfect eyesight. Childbirth took 3 to 4 hours. They had no mental illnesses. And this was documented over and over. You can still find in, you know, libraries some of these texts. I would really recommend Weston Price's book. That's the one that really still stands historically, and it's called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. And that is a book that even has photographs of some of these people. And the brilliance of his work also was that he showed what happened when people started to eat these foods. Because, you know, you have the parents who were raised eating their traditional animal source foods, and then the first generation of them begin to eat imported agricultural foods, and then you see the results in their children. And they're way too small, their teeth don't fit in their mouths anymore, some of them have things like club feet, arthritis at very young ages, and so you can see, you know, the entire history of the human race right there in one generation. So, you know, I know that that is very disturbing information, and it's not certainly not what any of us have been told, but it is there still to be found. The human template is based on an animal that needs to be fed, and if we do not give our bodies what they need, they will respond with illness.
That's Liara Keith. She's the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability. She's done a tremendous amount of research into nutrition and the diets of historical peoples. We have a few more minutes, so we'll try and squeeze in one more call.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, welcome. You're on Democracy in Action. Thanks for calling in.
Yes and no, though. The hunter-gatherers it wasn't just meat. They knew how to eat everything, correct?
But they didn't have grain, and that had not been domesticated yet. So they
not
certainly ate. They ate
grains,
fruit.
But they would eat some seeds and grains, but as well as roots and fruits of trees and acorns and fish and, you know, fowl and game animals and everything in balance, right? It wasn't just simply just harvesting meat.
There are cultures that survive entirely on meat. There are other
yes,
cultures that certain,
right,
that
but
do eat.
It depends on what the area supports.
Right. You can achieve perfect human health eating nothing but meat. You can also achieve perfect human health eating animal products plus some vegetable matter and some fruit. Grain, people did not eat grain until 10,000 years ago, and the results have been pretty stunningly awful for us, for our cultures, and for the planet.
Right. Whatever the area supports, though, that's what I'm asking you. Well, did I miss the big question? Is how many people can this area sustain?
That is a very good question. We know globally the Earth is projected to support only about 500 million people, and 130,000 people in Humboldt County is likely pushing overshoot And the bottom line is right. If we can, the people have to eat, and eating wild and local food is our best option at this point. If we didn't have to, if fish still swam in these rivers, we would not have to go to the grocery. Eating wild flora should certainly be a part of our diets, and this is an ongoing conversation. Which
I agree. Well, and so that's the big question is, I agree, the best way to sustain our living is to eat wild, local, homegrown, whatever we can get.
Pierre made a good point earlier that you have to ask what died to get the food on the plate. And another important question is what will die, and starting to take that moral consideration and not bringing in soybeans from Brazil, but looking to the boundary of Humboldt County and doing our best to remain within that limit is where we need to go to continue this conversation with the community. Erin, when will that food security forum be?
Saturday, February 27th at the D Street Community Center in Arcata. It's 1:30 to 5:30. And you can find out more information and register for the event at the North Coast Co-op website.
And to wrest control from the corporations who brought us genetically modified food and industrial factory farming without any votes or support from the...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of Redwood Community Radio. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of KMUD or renewing if you've already joined. A regular yearly membership is $50, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of Redwood Community Radio. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of KMUD or renewing if you've already joined. A regular yearly membership is $50, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.